The headlines: Bahrain's main opposition group and the top clerics strongly denounce the Israeli foreign minister's visit to Manama after a U.S. broker normalization deal. Israeli troops shoot and kill two Palestinians and injure two others in separate incidents in the occupied West Bank. And prominent Nigerian cleric Sheikh Ibrahim Zak Seki tells Press TV that the recent deadly crackdown on the Arbaeen March in Abuja was not justified. Our top story. For this half hour, Bahrain's main opposition group and the top cleric have denounced the kingdom's normalization of ties with Israel. Bahrain's dissolved opposition party, Al-Wafaq, says it rejects the visit of the Israeli foreign minister to Manama. It said any Israeli presence in Bahrain is a provocation to the sentiments of Bahraini, stressing that Yair Lapid must not set foot in Bahrain. Separately, top cleric Sheikh Issa Ahmad Qasim described Manama's normalization of ties with Tel Aviv as despicable and against the will of the Bahraini people. Bahrain was one of the four Arab states that normalized relations with the Israeli regime under a deal brokered by the U.S. last year. Israeli forces have fatally shot a young Palestinian woman in occupied Al-Quds. The regime forces claim the woman was hit while trying to stab a soldier near Al-Aqsa Mosque. The victim's identity remains unknown. Separately, a Palestinian man was killed and two others injured after Israeli forces opened fire during their pre-dawn raid in the West Bank town of Burin. A large crowd of Palestinians attended the funeral of 22-year-old Al-Anasir Zayu just hours after his killing. Israel continues its deadly mayhem in the occupied territories under different pretexts on an almost daily basis. Earlier this week, the regime forces killed at least five Palestinians after raiding several West Bank towns. Mona Kandil joined us earlier from Ramallah with more details on Israel's latest killings in the occupied territories.
The narration is that a Palestinian woman arrived at one of the gates inside the old town of Jerusalem, Al-Quds Bab al-Silsila, exactly, and she had a knife, and she tried to stab one of the Israeli soldiers there. They opened fire at her, and she was seriously wounded. They left her on the ground, bleeding, and then they searched her. They left her without allowing anyone to reach her or to help her. Also, another Palestinian was shot dead this morning. Israeli forces raided the village of Burqin, southwest Jenin in the occupied West Bank. They were carrying out an arrest operation. A number of Palestinians were wounded and transferred to Palestinian hospitals. And it was declared that this Palestinian man, Ala Ziyud, affiliated with the jihad movement, according to the jihad movement in Jenin. Then the Palestinians immediately took part in funeral procession in fear that the Israeli forces might raid the Palestinian hospital to detain his body.
We're going to go back to our top story for this half hour, where Bahrain's top Shia cleric Ayatollah Sheikh Issa Ahmad Qasim has called for a free democratic referendum in the country on the issue of Manama's normalization of ties with Tel Aviv. Political analyst Tariq Tahboub joins us now from Amman to offer us some more insight on the story. Mr. Tahboub, welcome to the program. Give us your thoughts on the recent developments that are taking place in Bahrain with regards to normalization of ties with the Israeli regime.
Well, these are recent events, there is a long process linked to the deal of the century. It's the deal of nowhere and no time, and this is just a roadmap to conduct to bring the Arab the Arab nation and the Arab countries on their knees to kneel before the Zionist regime. You said normalization. Normalization is not opening embassies. North Korea and the United States have embassies, and their relation is not normal. Normalization is when you get the well-wishing of the people, you get the acceptance of the people, you get the approval of the people, but cocktail parties and embassies represent nothing.
Let's talk about these states that have, for lack of a better word, have normalized ties with the Israeli regime. These Arab countries, are they turning their back, effectively turning their back on the suffering of their Arab brethren, the Palestinians?
Well, this is not new. I mean, for years now, we see that the suffering of the Palestinians, especially in the occupied territories, and even refugees in some Arab countries are treated with being as third-class citizens with no rights to travel, with no rights to work, with no rights to documentations, with no rights to go to school even. This is nothing new. I told you this has been a long process for the past 100 years to bring that Zionist project into the middle of the Arab nation, to divide the Arab nation, and to prevent it from attaining its full potential economically, politically, geographically, and scientifically. So this project is not new. If we consider that just opening embassies is really a big step, as I told you, normalization is acceptance of the people. Normalization is acceptance and well-wishing. And there is just one simple rule that we have to follow. No justice, no peace, no normalization. When justice is achieved and Palestine is given to its rightful people, its rightful owners, its population, then anybody with any religion can live in Palestine, which has been the rule for the past, you know, since creation was, that it is not your religion which determines your nationality. If you live peacefully with your neighbors and you don't occupy them, but if you start an ethnic cleansing, genocidal project like the Zionist project, there is no normalization with that and whatsoever. And I told you, opening embassies, exchanging cocktails, having dinners between diplomats, that means nothing. And someday, all of this, who participated in this will be brought to call. They will be, brought to justice, because if there is no justice, there will be no peace. And it's a promise for the whole world. Injustice anywhere is a threat to justice everywhere.
All right, we'll end it on that note. Political analyst Tariq Tafu joining us from the Jordanian capital, Amman. The 76th UN General Assembly has once again served as a podium for another Israeli prime minister to accuse Iran of falsehoods. The current Israeli premier, Naftali Bennett, accused Iran of pursuing a nuclear weapons program while again threatening the country with military action. Let's have a look.
Israeli Prime Minister Naftali Bennett used his first speech to the UN General Assembly to launch his anti-Iran rant. Bennett solely tried to tarnish Iran over its peaceful nuclear energy program. He alleged that Iran sought to control the Middle East region under a nuclear umbrella. Bennett claimed Iran's nuclear program has hit a watershed moment and, quote, all red lines have been crossed. Bennett accused Iran of violating safeguard agreements with the UN Atomic Energy Watchdog, the IAEA. The Israeli Prime Minister hinted at possible military action against Iran, accusing the Islamic Republic's nuclear program of crossing all red lines.
Iran's nuclear weapon program is at a critical point. All red lines have been crossed, inspections ignored, all wishful thinking proven false. Iran is currently violating the IAEA's safeguard agreements, and it's getting away with it.
And the speech itself, of course, full of lies. It was trying to listen to him is very, very irritating because it was one lie after another. From the beacon of he called a beacon of a lighthouse, a beacon to the world. Well, if he's a lighthouse, Israel is shining the light right towards the rocks. It's a false lighthouse. It's what Israel is doing is the opposite of what it pretends to be.
Bennett, who did not address Palestine by name during his speech, instead referred to the normalization of ties between Israel and several Arab countries. Israel claims its new diplomatic relations with the UAE and Bahrain, brokered by Washington last year, as having helped create a regional barricade against Iran.
The world is now accustomed to false Israeli claims when it comes to Iran's nuclear program. Who can ever forget former Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, who claimed that Iran was just months away from a nuclear bomb, and that was in the year 2012. It was followed by repeated false claims against Iran's civilian nuclear program. Israel has even attacked Iran's nuclear facilities under this false pretense.
Following Bennett's speech, Iran's permanent ambassador to the United Nations blasted the Israeli premier over his address to the UN General Assembly, which took the regime's smear campaign against the Islamic Republic to new heights. In a tweet, Majid Takht Ravanchi described Bennett's speech as lies, saying fear-mongering against Iran has been put to display at the UN. He also said the Israeli regime is in no position to discuss Iran's peaceful program when it has hundreds of nuclear warheads. Iran also warned that the occupying regime endangers peace and security in the region and beyond, as it possesses all types of weapons of mass destruction, as well as the most sophisticated conventional weapons.
Iran is the only country with the courage to stand up to Israel and to tell the truth as it is. And that's why it is victimized. That's why Israel is just eager to attack and kill as many Iranians as possible. It's a genocidal, just like against the Palestinians, it's genocide, and it would love to do that against Iran.
He, Bennett, played the victim and desperately tried to portray the Israeli regime as innocent. It is not surprising at all. Deception has always been part of their agenda. His mischievous objective is crystal clear: to cover up all expansionist and destabilizing policies and criminal practices of the Zionist regime in the region over the past 7 decades. Despite its constant denial, Tel Aviv has been running a notorious and highly secretive nuclear weapons program, the only one in the region that has provided it with at least 200 non-conventional warheads.
I don't know how the world can listen to the lies coming out of Israel, and we all know that Israel has nuclear weapons against the international agreements. It's developed its own nuclear weapons program. It threatens Europe even. It says if you turn against us, we can bomb Berlin. There, I've seen quotes from senior Israeli officials. So,
throughout the years, the occupying regime has also assassinated at least 7 Iranian nuclear scientists and tried to interfere with the Islamic Republic's nuclear work through various ways. Iran's nuclear facilities have come under at least 3 sabotage operations over the past year, in which the occupying regime is the prime suspect.
Prominent Nigerian cleric Sheikh Ibrahim Zakzaki says the 2014 massacre in the northern city of Zaria was a pre-planned crackdown by the government.
What happened in Zaria in 2014 was a pre-planned crackdown, even though they have no way to justify what they did, except because they were so confused as to say that there was a blockade of road.
In an exclusive interview with Press TV, Zakzaki said as many as 1,200 people were killed in the carnage, and many more were injured. The cleric noted that the Zaria massacre was the worst of its kind, but opened the eyes and ears of the people. Zakzaki also said the recent Debi crackdown on the Arba'in March in the capital Abuja was not justified. Elsewhere in his remarks, Zakzaki said the people of his country will opt for an Islamic democracy if given the choice.
We want democracy, isn't it? What is the meaning of the democracy? It is a government of the people. I believe that if there will be a plebiscite in this country where people will be asked, which system would you like? Is it the status quo, which is inherited of the British colonialists, or the Islamic system? Just cast a vote on one of them. I'm sure a majority will choose Islamic system.
Zakzaki said Nigerian authorities fear of the influence of the Islamic movement in the country. However, he added, they should have nothing to fear as the people are after a democratic system. While condemning Debi violence, the cleric underlined that the persecution of Muslims in Nigeria started many years ago. Elsewhere in his remarks, Zakzaki stressed that the 1979 Islamic Revolution in Iran had a, quote, tremendous impact on his ideology. He also expressed hope that the oppression of Palestinian people by the Israeli regime will come to an end. The number of daily coronavirus cases in Australia's second largest city, Melbourne, has hit a record high. Officials in the capital of Victoria State reported 1,438 new cases, the largest one-day tally since the start of the pandemic. The surge comes despite 2 months of lockdown on the city to contain the disease. The peak in infections is set to be linked to ongoing street protests, illegal gatherings, and house parties on the Australian Football League's grand final. Meanwhile, police were seen patrolling the streets to impose the restrictions. Australia has reported more than 105,000 cases and over 1,200 related deaths so far. New South Wales and Victoria states remain the hardest hit. And that's a wrap for now. Bye, everybody.
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/ParsTodayEN. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/ParsTodayEnglish. Tourism. name of God, salam, and welcome to the 11th program in our series, Health Tourism. In this episode, we are going to take you to the city of Yazd in Iran and introduce you to Shahid Sarughi Hospital in this central Iranian city. Please stay tuned. We have once again come to the city of Yazd to get more acquainted with the tourist areas of this city and also get familiar with one of the city's well-known hospitals, which also operates in the field of health tourism. The city of Yazd is located between the Shirku and Kharagnak mountains in a wide plain called the Yazd-Ardakan Plain. Some geographers attribute the date of construction of Yazd to Yazdgerd I, the Sassanid king. But in the Atabakan ruling period, which was one of the feudal dynasties in this region, the city of Yazd developed significantly. Preserving its historical identity, the city of Yazd has become one of the most beautiful cities in Iran today. Historic buildings and monuments abound in the city, and traditional markets and bazaars situated in the old part of the city are all among recreational and tourist attractions of the city of Yazd. The historic city of Yazd includes various old neighborhoods, but among all of them, Fahadan neighborhood is one of the oldest. In this historic city, you can still find many houses belonging to Ilkhanate, that is Ilkhani period, and to the Qajar period. These traditional old style houses almost invariably feature a central courtyard, a hall, 3-door and 5-door rooms, high walls, beautiful decoration inside the house, picturesque surroundings, and it is interesting that these old houses are still residential and people live in them. Preserving the traditional and historic structure of the city of Yazd has attracted many domestic and foreign tourists to this city. Therefore, a large number of traditional houses in Yazd have been transformed and refurbished into residences suitable for tourists. In fact, tourists can become acquainted with the lifestyle of the people of this city by staying in these refurbished houses. These traditional residences are mostly located in the old part of Yazd. The city of Yazd, steeped in history, is able to attract many foreign tourists with its fascinating places to visit. But the city has also taken significant steps in the field of health tourism for several years and is trying to be successful in attracting health tourists as well. Health tourism is currently one of the most popular kinds of tourism, which in addition to providing health services, will also boost other areas of tourism, such as hotels, transportation, and other sectors of the economy. In the following, we will further discuss the emerging and successful health tourism industry in Yazd. Stay with us. As mentioned earlier, the city of Yazd has taken some valuable steps in the field of health tourism in recent years and is trying to use its urban and historical attractions as well as improving its medical infrastructure to attract even more health tourists. Currently, there are 14 public hospitals in Yazd with 1,582 beds and 7 private hospitals with 983 beds that are offering a range of medical services to patients. Yazd is a leading city in several medical fields such as infertility treatment, cardiovascular disease, dentistry, gynecology, treatment of cancer and diabetes. Several hospitals in Yazd have successfully obtained International Patients Department Permit, that is IPD, in the field of medical tourism for the treatment of foreign patients. One of these hospitals is Shahid Sarughi Hospital, which also accepts foreign patients after receiving its license. Located in southeast part of Yazd in the Safoye district, Shahid Sarughi Hospital was inaugurated in 2001. The hospital is housed in a modern building with a combination of international standards and Iranian architectural art. This hospital is built on a plot of land measuring 50 hectares, and 45,000 square meters of medical space has been built on 5 floors. This modern and well-equipped hospital is known as the largest governmental educational medical and research center in central and southeastern Iran. The hospital has 1,600 personnel, of which 200 doctors and 600 nurses offer medical services to patients. Shahid Sarughi Hospital has succeeded to receive a national first degree accreditation certificate and also has an international patients department, IPD, which has made this hospital one of the best medical centers in Yazd. Shahid Sarughi Hospital consists of different wards, including inpatient ward, paraclinic ward, and emergency ward. Each of them provides different services to patients. The women's ward of the hospital has 30 beds, and all its rooms are fully equipped with medical equipment, as well as a TV, refrigerator, and a sofa to cater for the patient and anyone accompanying him or her, as well as a nurse call system. The operating rooms of the hospital also include two sections of general surgery and gynecological surgery. In the general ward, there are 13 operating beds and 34 recovery beds. And in the gynecology ward, there are 3 operating beds and 5 recovery beds. Having this number of surgical beds makes it possible to perform several operations at the same time. The international patient ward of the hospital is located on the ground floor, and the reception, treatment, and hospitalization services for foreign patients are provided in this ward. The doctors of the IPD department of the hospital are among the best specialists and super specialists who are in charge of all the medical affairs of the foreign patients. Foreign patients are referred to the relevant doctors in the shortest possible time after being admitted to this ward and providing required documents, and the treatment process begins afterwards. In the case of the need for hospitalization or surgery, the follow-ups will be carried out by the international ward personnel. Due to the potentials and capacities in the city of Yazd, especially the successful records in the field of in vitro fertilization or IVF, or infertility treatment founded by Professor Aflatunian in Yazd many years ago, many patients come to this city for infertility treatment. Shahid Sarughi Hospital in Yazd has expressed readiness for various kinds of treatments due to these potentials and enjoying from super specialty departments and doctors. The hospital is also trying to promote the hospital through media and tourism companies, and to upgrade its position in order to attract more medical tourists. Dear listeners, that was the 11th episode of the series Health Tourism. Until our next program, goodbye and God bless.
Spotlight. joining us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of information.
The Spotlight.
Hello, welcome to the Spotlight. Fishing rights for EU boats in UK waters was a key stumbling block in negotiations for a Brexit trade accord between London and Brussels, which threatened to sink the deal. Well, it has resurfaced again. Britain said that it would grant just 12 out of 47 applications for new licenses for small EU boats, and then 75 applications from French boats to fish in its territorial waters. France has promised retaliation. In this edition of the Spotlight, we will look at why the UK is going against this agreement that was made on the Brexit talks. Let's get some details from Mina Taylor, our correspondent who joins us from London. Well, obviously, France is angry. It is promising retaliation, Amina, and tell us more details behind the story.
Well, it seems this is yet another war of words salvo here from the British, and you can justifiably see why the French are upset. There was the promise that vessels that were 12 meters and under and who had a proven record of fishing in inshore British waters would be granted the license, providing everything was above board. And by rejecting 75% of those French applications, the Brits, according to the French, are using this as political gain. Now, we have to recall that not only were these negotiations to try and sort out fishing rights really tense in the lead up to the signing of Brexit, we're even talking back in May here, where boats from the United Kingdom were sent out to Jersey to protect the Jersey coast there after there was a French flotilla to really protest against what they saw as the Brits unnecessarily and unfairly dealing with their ships. So we see things are already tense with France. We had that Australia US deal just a few weeks ago where ambassadors were recalled. There are still tensions around Brexit. There are those who say perhaps this is a smokescreen in time for the Tory party conference on the weekend to show that we're back to meaning business about Brexit, and it doesn't matter if we offend our one-time closest ally in order to do so. Watch this space, Carvey.
Okay, Brexit just doesn't end, does it? Okay, very well. Thank you for that, Amina. We appreciate it. Let's bring in senior analyst at Foreign Policy in Focus, Ian Williams. Also joining us, historian and investigative journalist Tony Gosling, who joins us from Bristol.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Okay, welcome to you both. Tony Gosling, I'm going to start with you first here. If you can, give us a quick wrap-up, even though our first one kind of did. But tell us exactly what's going on here.
Okay, so look, the background to this is Britain was, I stress, was a great maritime power, obviously, particularly during the Second World War, and they absolutely dominated. We dominated this part of the world. We could fish pretty much where we wanted to, and also could stop others fishing where you didn't want to. But that all changed when we joined the European Union. And around about the same time, in fact, we had a Cod War with the Icelandics, because we were pushing closer and closer the British fishing vessels to Iceland. And so the Icelandics, quite rightly, you know what they did? They extended their fishing range around Iceland, so pushing the British back. And in fact, in 1974, I think it was, there was even a pursuit over 100 nautical miles of a British fishing ship by the Icelandics, who successfully shot at it and captured it because they'd been fishing within the new limit. So this is quite a hot issue in the past. I think this is why the British have now decided that they're only going to award a quarter of the licenses the French have asked for. Now, let's be clear here. It is in the British government's behest to award or not award these licenses. So they will be looking through every application to find any tiny little mistake that the French have made in order to reject that application. So they're dealing with a hostile bureaucracy, basically. And I think it's only fair also to stress that one of the main priorities of the British at the moment is trying to restore stocks of fish, because we've had, under the European Union, a massive depletion of fishing stocks around the British Isles, and one of the main priorities of the British government has been to try and restore those fish stocks. So they're trying. I mean, we haven't got, the British don't have the fishing fleet to fish anything like what we used to do, but they are trying to make sure that all the I's are dotted and all the T's are crossed and all of these applications before they're granting the rights to these French. So I would suggest that actually these French fishing owners, rather than trying to turn this into a row, to just double-check that they've got everything right on these applications, send them in again before they make too much of a fuss, because this is now the British's right to say whether or not they can fish there.
Do you agree with that, Ian Williams?
There is plenty of room for misunderstanding all around. The European fisheries deal was one of the worst aspects of the EU accession for Britain. It destroyed what was left almost of Britain's commercial fishing fleet, and it threw open the so-called British waters. I don't think the fish carry passports, by the way, but it threw open the British waters to competition from lightly regulated, highly subsidized continental fishing fleets. The British government has not really believed in subsidies, certainly not the way the Europeans do. So, I mean, the whole economics of deep sea fishing is very murky at the best of times. There's huge subsidies, huge DAS discounts, because these are very vociferous and noisy political constituencies, no more so than the French. The French fishermen were threatening to blockade the port, threatening to blockade Calais. There are different attitudes here. The French fishermen and French peasants can get away with things like that. I wouldn't like to try it if I was an English fisherman or an English farmer trying to blockade the main road. I think the British police would take a very dull view and wouldn't really notice whether or not you're a politically important constituency or not. They bulldoze right through you and arrest you all. So it's different. There's a clash here. But certainly the point is, the European, these waters have been drastically overfished. There's far more fish coming out of them than is sustainable. And it's very difficult to police, because in the terms of the UN treaty, these are straddling and highly migratory fish stocks. They move from spawning grounds to other parts, from one end of the North Sea to the other. Whose fish are they? But one of the points is, how do you enforce a fishing quota? What you do is you haul the fish out and see what you've got, and then you either throw them back in, which is extremely wasteful if you've overfished, say, for monkfish or cod, and you've caught too many, you throw them back in. That does nothing for the fish stocks. It does tick off boxes for regulation. Or what is equally likely is, if you're a typical fisherman who doesn't really believe in this regulation stuff, you'll try to smuggle them out and use them anyway. And then you won't really want to declare your movements when you come to apply for a fishing license on the grounds that you have traditionally been in certain areas. You'll say, what, me in that area? No, I never lifted 1,000 tons of illegal cod from that area, ever. It's a very fraught and difficult position, messed up by politics and the economics of fisheries, which are not economic at all. I mean,
well,
I'm a fond fisherman myself, it's good for your brain, but the economics of where they're lifted from, how they're transported, the fuel that's used, the environmental devastation that takes place with the trawling, it is not something you can put your hand on your heart and say, fish is good for you.
Right. Well, I'm sorry, Tony Gosling, but I need to... I'm a bit confused here. I'm trying to figure out... maybe you could clarify this for us. What the agreement is, what are we looking at when it comes to the fish quantity that Ian Williams talked about there, and whether it's a fair agreement or not, so we can get an idea here and why it is. I mean, you said that the UK is looking for errors that are in the applications, I guess. But overall, what are we looking at in terms of what's right and what's fair? And ultimately, if you can tell us, Tony Gosling, well, there was a deal that was made in the form of Brexit, which included this. So who's in the right and who's in the wrong?
Well, for decades, really, you know, 50 years or so, British, I mean, I've seen it in my lifetime. You know, I'm 58 years old. Our fishing ports have been absolutely decimated around Britain. So, you know, ports where there might have been 20, 30 fishing vessels, that's a small port, have dwindled down sometimes to only one or two fishing vessels or none at all. And that's really because the management of the resources of the seas has been managed from Brussels, no longer from Britain. And so there is, I think, you know, quite a righteous anger, really, in the way that that industry has been decimated. Britain, obviously, is a traditionally a maritime nation. But I really want to point out that the timing of this is very interesting. You know, this is quite clearly a sort of row relating to Brexit. We've also seen... The lack of tanker drivers dispute going on here in Britain over the last week or so, which is also very much related to Brexit and to a certain extent confected, because we know that the oil companies can afford to pay double wages to delivery drivers if they really want to. These people are not short of cash, as anyone involved in the oil industry will tell you. And then we've also had this international geopolitical dispute with the French over the submarines as well, which has got a kind of nautical flavour too, hasn't it? The British and the Americans agreeing to supply nuclear submarines, nuclear-powered submarines, to the Australians under the noses of the French. So it seems to me that this may be a symptom of a much wider problem, and that is the general idea of Brexit, which is rather strange, isn't it? Because it's a couple of years since Brexit, and yet it's taken a while for these things to work their way through. I'll also point out, though, that we've got something else going on in Britain. This could be to do with the timing of this, and that is it's the party conference season. This week, it's the Labour Party conference, and next week, the Conservative Party conference. And so these are the sorts of issues which will be being played out in those fringe meetings and in the major debates in those conferences.
Uh-huh.
And the political leaders will be trying to use these disputes in order to assert their... their readiness to lead the country through these difficult times.
Sure.
So there's a lot going on at the same time here that I think we should be very, I think, pay attention to the timing of this.
Okay, so let's expand more on the timing and also to get your impression on this, Ian Williams. And before I get your reaction to what our guest Tony Gosling there said, France's Maritime Minister, Annick Girardin, let me make sure I'm pronouncing this correctly, Girardin, said French fishing should not be taken hostage by the British for political ends. It sounds like from what Tony Gosling said that maybe that is what may be going on based on the timing. Do you think that's the case?
Well, look, I think it was the worst part of the deal. I think one of the reasons where Boris Johnson showed he was a liar and Nigel Farage, they said that if we had Brexit, then British fisheries would return. They didn't. All the European Union fisheries carried on getting 65% of the quotas of the fish from the waters. I think it's 65%. But there's another aspect where the European fisheries regime might almost be working, and it's coincidence it happened today, but the European courts have ruled that the European Union had no right to sign a fishing treaty with Morocco about Western Saharan fish. So, you know, fish are moving into the center of the of maritime disputes. As you know, Trump declared that he accepted Western Sahara to be part of Morocco, even though the United Nations hasn't, and the courts haven't, and the European courts have ruled that Western Sahara is occupied territory, and that the Moroccans, with their French backers, by the way, their French backers, are not allowed to take the fisheries and to give it and to sell the fish there, except for the benefit of the Western Saharans. And just to add to the hypocrisy, I remember some years ago when this dispute was at the United Nations about the straddling fish stocks, the French were in dispute with Canada because they have two offshore islands, like Jersey and Guernsey, just offshore from Canada, and they were fishing right up to them, the full quota. They were fishing in effectively Canadian waters and overfishing, according to the Canadians. So we had a huge dispute there as well. So there are no halos here. No, there are no wings and no shiny armor. The British government lied to its own people. It lied to Europe. French quite right there. It's probably being very bureaucratically punctilious about the licenses, but then it's very likely that the French fishermen were lying in their applications by claiming that they're in places that they weren't and denying that they're in places where they were. I mean, there's a lot of anarchy going around here, and you know the regime is pretty much unenforceable. And of course, the fish don't get a vote in this; they don't get passports or votes.
Well, again, I'm going to refer to a statement here made, Tony Gosselin, by the French Maritime Minister, where she has said, "I count on other European countries to ask for the same thing as France, because what France is going through, they will go through the same thing, the same bad will from Britain, which will not be expressed only on this issue." Do you think that the UK will take up other issues that will be out of the agreement of Brexit, perhaps?
Well, look, I don't think that's the case at all. I think what's happening is Brussels and Paris are picking a fight here with the Brits. I mean, you know, they can apply for these licenses again. You'll probably find that most of those that were turned down will be accepted if they're written down honestly, and that these people are actually entitled to fish now. But, you know, this is something which I think it only benefits Brussels by doing this, because what they tend to do is they want to send a message, don't they, to all those other countries that are getting sick and tired of the European Union. And I'm talking here, actually, there's many in France, including the Yellow Vests, who were so cleverly gotten out of the way by all these COVID measures in France, the very strict curfews and things like that. They wanted out of the European Union. They see it as a rich man's club. The same is true in Greece, in many other countries in the EU. In fact, there's many in Germany that want out of the whole Brussels arrangement as well. So these various countries are looking at Britain. How are they getting on? And it actually looks like Britain's been doing reasonably well, doesn't it? Not too many problems over here so far. And so I think we're going into a sort of silly season here, where the European Union, and the French particularly at the moment, are doing everything they can to stir things up, and also to try and make it look as if the UK, and actually have quite a lot of allies within Britain, these big mega corporations, transnational corporations, who are also pro-EU, that are, some of which are based in London, and they are doing whatever they can to stir things up. And this is just simply another example. And it's getting really nasty. I see today in Jersey, they believe in this little Channel Island just off the coast of France, which is owned by the Brits, that they're actually considering now that they may have a blockade of their port, because so many of these licenses of the ships based in, the French ships based in Jersey, have been turned down. So they just have to accept this, I think, and it's part of the Brexit deal. If they want to fish, they need a license, and I'm afraid that's just part of the deal. They have to suck it up, I'm afraid.
In Williams, is that going to happen? Do you think the French fishermen especially will do that?
As I said, the French peasantry and the fishermen have a sort of a collective attitude, which is almost proletarian. They believe in collective action. They will dump tomatoes and potatoes on the road to port. They'll dump rotten fish in places. They will collectively blockade ports. Now, they're allowed to do that because they're a politically important constituency. In Britain, they're not. You know, if they blockaded the port of Dover, then I'm sure a Navy frigate would just go right through the middle of them after due warning. And, you know, they've had it. I'm not sure if that's a good thing or a bad thing, but the whole, I did not agree with Britain going to the European Union, but when it did, and recently, I didn't agree with it coming out. I think that Brexit has been a complete disaster all along, and it provides over and over expedient reasons for the government to lie and cheat. The Boris Johnson's government lied about Northern Ireland and they broke the agreement, and the sad thing is that for all of its many faults, perfidious Albion, the UK, for many years was actually outstanding for its application of European law, even when it was inconvenient to itself. Unlike some other countries, particularly in the Mediterranean, where the attitude was you took whatever money came from the UN and you refused to accept their responsibilities. If you look at Hungary now, for example, where they want all the UN's, the European Union subsidies, but refuse to accept any of the regulations and the stipulations about free courts that go with it. Britain has been better than that, but in the last few years, it hasn't been. It's sunk into, they're wallowing in the mud with everybody else. Mm-hmm. So there's no telling. There'll be lots of mud to be thrown from both sides.
Okay.
And neither of them are going to be angelic with halos or wings about it. They're all going to be covered in mud. And sure. They deserve it. But they've all been involved in sordid politics.
Okay, well, Tony Gosselin, you got this, you got the thing with AUKUS in terms of what happened. Lots of tensions there that have been created. But my question to you is how badly is this relationship at this point negatively affected? And is this just a temporary thing, or how do you see it? How do you project this to go?
Well, okay, so I think our relationship with the French has always been pretty up and down. I mean, though we're very close by, with a very, different language, a different culture. In many ways, the French have got a fantastic culture, haven't they? The food and all that. I mean, we love visiting France, but in terms of the European Union, which the French really represent, they are the EU's in the front line for the EU against Britain. And they're seen, Macron particularly, is seen as the sort of person that has got to teach the Brits a lesson. And I think there's a lot of that almost infantile stuff going on here. The deals have all been signed, and to a certain extent, the British have got some very difficult... I mean, we've been used to being dependent on European trade for many, many years, and that's got quite easy for some people. Very, very easy, in fact, to get all sorts of goods across the channel, but without very much paperwork. And now, actually, what's happened is, over the last couple of years, all the British industries have done, I think, very well in sourcing stuff much more locally, in going through the paperwork and importing stuff when they need to, but actually being more self-sufficient. And I think that's actually quite important in the modern world, particularly with all the geopolitical tensions, that the British are independent here. We've done a fairly good job in making sure that we're establishing control over some resources that we've ceded.
I got to jump in, Tony Gosselin. Sorry, give Ian Williams 30 seconds before we end this. Ian Williams, I saw you shaking your head. Go ahead.
I think the British government have made a disastrous job. They weren't prepared. They didn't seem to realize that Dover was the ports of Dover and Calais were the main route for most goods. They haven't managed to substitute stuff. They have managed to destroy British industry single-handed since the days of Margaret Thatcher. And I come from an industrial area. I watched it happen. I can show you the factories where they used to be. They destroyed British industry. Part of that process was joining the European Union. Since then, they've managed to destroy it all over again because what industry there was left was dependent on an intricate network across Europe, which they're now disrupting for infantile political flag-waving reasons.
Unfortunately, we're fresh out of time. Thank you very much for that. Let me thank Amina Taylor, a correspondent, spoke to us at the top of the hour, senior analyst of Foreign Policy and Focus, Ian Williams, speaking there from New York. And thank you, Tony Gosselin, historian and investigative journalist from Bristol. And with that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Mikhail Tatlay and the team, it's goodbye until next time.
This is IRIB English Radio. please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/EM.
This is Back to Reality.
Back to Reality.
It's the show where we discuss the most topical of topics, the most controversial of controversies, and the most important affairs of affairs.
Roundtable from Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, in the name of God, welcome to another edition of the program Back to Reality on IRIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program. And we are here sitting in the studio with two of my friends, and let me ask them actually to introduce themselves.
Assalamu alaikum, Brother Habib, at your service from California of the United States of America, most expensive state in the United States actually.
I see.
At your service.
Okay, thank you very much. And brother?
Assalamu alaikum, Muzaffar Haider here from the UK.
Oh, great. Okay, one of the topics which becomes recurrently important is that, you know, we talk about culture in many societies. When people gather together in communities, in fact, we are looking at a lot of things. But one of the most important things in that is the culture of that community, right? Mm-hmm. Well, so what items do you think that makes Muslims different from other cultures?
Okay, well, there's lots of different things, obviously, right. And I'm sure we're going to discuss a lot of those different elements of those things.
Right.
But one thing that comes to mind is hijab, because it's such a visual reminder of who we are. You know, I believe it was Imam Khomeini who said that women are the flag bearers of Islam.
Right.
When I first heard this statement, I don't know about you, Brother Habib, but I honestly felt jealous of women for the first time.
Nice.
I wish that I could be a flag bearer of Islam. And obviously the Quran also says that the hijab has been prescribed for what? So that you may be known, so that you can be recognized.
Mm-hmm.
So when we see a Muslimah going into a non-Muslim environment,
right,
wearing that hijab proudly, it really makes us stand apart.
The odd one,
you know?
Out.
Not necessarily. That's usually a negative way to look at it.
Yeah, exactly.
It can be a negative way
but
as well.
But without the negative connotation.
Without the negative connotation. It makes her stand out,
mm-hmm,
you know? Everybody
yes,
knows
exactly.
This is a Muslim. There's a different kind of aura around her.